National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the August 25th, 2021 edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Central Time to discuss national security. We'll bring in guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore challenges in national security. So thank you for joining us today. You may recall we've previously had two shows on nuclear weapons. This will be the third and is a continuation of a show we did back in May with Professor Mark Bell. As a reminder, Mark Bell is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Minnesota. Professor Bell's research examines issues relating to nuclear weapons and proliferation, international relations theory, and U.S. and British foreign policy. His first book, Nuclear Reactions, How Nuclear-Armed States Behave, examines how states change their foreign policies when they acquire nuclear weapons and is published with Cornell University Press as part of the Cornell Studies in Security Affairs series. Mark Bell holds a doctorate in political science from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a master's in public policy from the Harvard Kennedy School, where he was a Frank Knox Memorial Fellow, and a Bachelor of Arts in Politics, Philosophy, and Economics from St. Anne's College at Oxford University. Professor Mark Bell, welcome back to National Security This Week.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
I see you're in. We are on Zoom, you and me. I see you're in your office at the U campus. Is that right?
I am. Yeah, back in the office at least for the time being.
When do classes start up?
Classes start back up after Labor Day. So I think the 8th or the 6th, something around then.
Okay. So we do have a lot to discuss today. Let's go ahead and jump right in. When you were here back in May, we covered a wide range of topics regarding nuclear-armed nations, nuclear treaties, and related topics. Unfortunately, we ran out of time and weren't able to get into the latest developments in nuclear weapons delivery capabilities and how those capabilities might alter the deterrent strategies nations have employed successfully for many decades. So, Professor Bell, if you're amenable, I'd like to pick up where we left off last time. Is that okay?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. So first question, and we'll start with the United States on this one. What does the United States have in the way of new or advanced delivery systems, things that we're working on right now as a nation? And how would the U.S. use nuclear weapons in a conflict under these new delivery capabilities? That's a very broad question. But
yeah, so to give a sort of bit of context, I mean the U.S. basically, I mean, I think the sort of way to understand it is that the U.S. has the most capable and potent nuclear arsenal in the world, right? It has large numbers of land-based missiles, many of them not so far away from here in the Dakotas. Those are kind of aging somewhat. There's various discussions about what they should be replaced with, on what timeline they should be replaced. All right, so that's the land-based force. The U.S. has a submarine force that can launch missiles from sea. That's recently been the subject of some discussion. The Trump administration brought in a new low-yield submarine launch ballistic missile for various reasons that we can discuss, and particularly related to Russia. And then it has the Air Force component of so those three components are what are called the triad, right? And roughly speaking, the U.S. has about 6,000 warheads, of which a bit under sort of 4,000 are part of the kind of active stockpile rather than being retired or awaiting dismantlement. And of that 4,000, about 1,300 or so are currently sort of actively deployed on missiles, on submarines, on bombers, and so on. So that's sort of what the United States has. I think one of the most sort of important features of the U.S. arsenal, really, in addition to how sort of varied the arsenal is in terms of delivery systems and platforms, is the range of yields that these nuclear weapons have. You know, we think about nuclear weapons as being these huge or having these huge explosions, which is certainly true. But there's also a lot of variation, right? And U.S. nuclear weapons go from being, some of them are very low yield or can be sort of dialed to have a very low yield, as low as sort of a fraction of a kiloton. Kiloton is sort of 1,000 tons of TNT equivalent is how nuclear weapons yields are measured. So to a fraction of a kiloton up to several hundred kilotons. So unlike a lot of nuclear weapon states, unlike most nuclear weapon states, in fact, the U.S. has a very varied, very powerful arsenal. And that reflects, I think, a couple of things about, you know, you asked about how the U.S. might use nuclear weapons. I mean, the U.S. has never been satisfied in the way that at least some other countries have been, with just thinking about nuclear weapons as a tool for retaliating, right? Or thinking that the purpose of nuclear weapons is simply to deter other countries from using them, right? That's sort of the more defensive nuclear posture that some countries have adopted. The United States has always had a much more sort of offensive nuclear posture that emphasizes and is optimized for going first in a conflict, for actually potentially fighting a war with nuclear weapons, for taking out an adversary's nuclear arsenal. That's what we call counterforce rather than countervalue, which is simply sort of about hitting cities. And obviously, if you want to do counterforce, if you want to go after kind of the hardened targets that, that states have, the their mobile missiles that maybe, you know, they have various ways of hiding, you want to go after the other states' submarines, but you need a lot more accuracy, you need a lot more capability, you need a lot more sort of maneuverability of your weapons. And so the U.S. arsenal and a lot of the capabilities that the United States is developing, in some ways, you know, are sort of all kind of aimed around that in a lot of ways, right? The U.S. arsenal reflects a commitment to be able to do those things that a lot of countries simply haven't tried to do. And so in many ways, some of the most interesting sort of recent developments are less about the nuclear weapons themselves and are more about the sort of intelligence or the satellite technology, the accuracy, all of which allows the United States potentially to, you know, try to take out another country's nuclear weapons at a first strike, to try to make it more credible that the United States would, you know, defend allies in a war and so on. So that's sort of the broad picture of the U.S. arsenal. Sorry, I talked for a while there, but that's the broad picture of the U.S. arsenal and what it would be used for.
And if I could, what I'll do is sort of summarize what I think I heard you talking about here is that the U.S. has retained from a strategic position a willingness to use them first, to use them in an offensive role, nuclear weapons. And we have very capable dial-a-yield nuclear weapons that we can choose very specifically how we want to use them, whether in sort of quote-unquote a tactical situation or more of a strategic role. I think anytime you would use a nuclear weapon, it's immediately strategic in nature. But you know, from a yield perspective, it might be a somewhat lower yield. So from a delivery systems capability, that's really what we're talking about here is some significant changes in delivery capabilities. Can you talk a little bit about what the U.S. has been working on in those areas?
Yeah, so I mean, so as I said, right, the you know, there's a big program or sort of debate underway about how quickly and whether to upgrade the land-based missiles. U.S. intercontinental ballistic missiles that launch from silos in, you know, the Dakotas or wherever, are pretty old technologies at this point. Yeah. And there's sort of been a debate about how and when to upgrade those. And those, at the moment, there's sort of a modernization process going on. There's some debate about whether that might get slowed down. So that's sort of one thing. As I mentioned, the Trump administration brought in this new low-yield submarine launched missile that I think first started to be deployed in maybe 2018 or around then. And so you're seeing, and then they're sort of constantly developing, as I mentioned, these sort of space-based capabilities, ISR capabilities, anti-submarine warfare capabilities, accuracy capabilities, all of which have sort of developed significantly in their abilities over the last few decades, many of which remain classified. You know, we don't know a lot of the details about some of these things, but all of which sort of add to the U.S.'s sort of ability to use nuclear weapons in, as you say, a very sort of precise way. I mean, yeah, to the extent that you can ever be precise with weapons of that size.
all relative, right?
Use them for, sorry?
It's all relative?
Right, exactly, yeah.
Horseshoes, hand grenades, and nuclear weapons, close counts?
Right. Yeah.
So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Professor Mark Bell from the University of Minnesota. We're continuing our discussion from May of this year regarding nuclear strategy, nuclear deterrence, and advanced nuclear weapons delivery capabilities. So Mark, let's shift over to Russia. Obviously, you just mentioned that a lot of what the U.S. has been working on remains in the classified world. Thankfully, we have diligent members of the press corps all around the world who've been publishing things a little more precisely about what Russia is doing, and even China, and we'll get into China a little bit later. But let's shift over to Russia. What is the latest on Russia's nuclear strategy? I haven't heard that they've been working on new nuclear warhead technologies, but they are focused pretty heavily on delivery capabilities. Let's start with their nuclear strategy. What do you see developing in Russia today as far as nuclear strategy and deterrence goes?
Yeah, the Russian case is a really interesting one. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, the sort of broad picture is that, like the United States, Russia has a sort of big, diverse nuclear force. I mean, in general, the Russian force is a little less cutting edge than the United States, a little less potent, a little less optimized for first use and counterforce. But in the grand scheme of things, Russia is the only other state that has a sort of comparable nuclear arsenal to that the United States has. And I think the big question at the moment with respect to Russia and how their nuclear strategy is evolving is that there's a lot of concern in D.C. that Russia is moving towards what some people are calling this sort of escalate to de-escalate strategy. I mean, escalate to de-escalate is a little bit of a sort of euphemism. I mean, it's really an escalate to win strategy.
Right.
And the idea is that, you know, Russia might try to take some territory, say, in Eastern Europe, maybe more of Ukraine, part of a NATO, Eastern European NATO ally, something like that. But they would do that conventionally. And then they would basically threaten to use low-yield nuclear weapons tactically against the United States or other NATO forces to try and deter the United States from retaliating to try to take that territory back.
And if I can just interject very quickly, yeah. What we have seen in Russian military exercises over the last few years is exactly that same scenario playing out in how they decide they're gonna run their war games.
Right, right.
It's a little concerning, right?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, and this was part of the argument that for the low yield submarine launch ballistic missile that the Trump administration put forward, right? That you would need a sort of low-yield response to be able to deter Russia from using that low-yield option. And therefore, once you had that, that would stop Russia from thinking that they could prevail in that sort of kind of fait accompli in Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, though, I mean, in some ways, you know, we talk about this in nuclear terms. In some ways, though, this is really a sort of conventional military problem, right? I mean, the real issue is that the United States and NATO is worried that it doesn't have the conventional military capability to deter that initial Russian attack on those states. And so trying to kind of come up with a sort of nuclear response to that after the fact is always going to be like a little bit tricky, I think, and isn't quite a sort of satisfactory solution to that problem.
It does sort of put the strategic thinkers and the military planners in the U.S. and NATO sort of in a difficult situation when you have to consider, well, how do we blunt a Russian offensive into a full-scale Russian offensive into Ukraine, or worse, into one of the Baltic states, for instance, if they want to kind of reunite that part of the old Soviet Union.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's a ton of evidence that Russia is sort of itching to do this on an imminent basis.
No.
You know, and this is not a problem that the United States is unfamiliar with, right? It's a problem that the United States dealt with throughout the Cold War, when the Soviet military was far closer to kind of core allies, was far more capable than the Russian military is today. So this, you know, in some ways, this is not a new problem.
Right.
But part of the issue is that NATO has pushed so far east that it sort of starts to become a little less credible that the United States would think about defending those states. You know, the United States could make a pretty credible case that, you know, West Germany or France were sort of crucial to its grand strategy and crucial to its national interests in a way that it's much harder to do for Estonia or Latvia. And I think that sort of inherent reduction in the credibility of the commitment the United States has tried to make, I think sort of adds to this kind of concern, right? That therefore it's going to be harder to persuade the Russians that you might fight to defend those states.
Yeah, that is true. So let's move over to from Russian nuclear strategy to talk specifically about new delivery capabilities that we know the Russians are working on. What are the Russians developing these days, and how should the U.S. think about those delivery capabilities?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's really sort of tricky to interpret, right? I mean, I think, you know, we've certainly heard reports and we've heard things about various sort of kind of exotic delivery systems that the Russians are sort of trying out. You know, we've heard about sort of nuclear-powered cruise missiles and potentially nuclear-powered torpedoes and all sorts of weird and kind of crazy things. And I think it's just very hard to know how seriously we should take that, right?
Yep.
Are these things they're developing because they're really sort of they think they are important parts of their nuclear arsenal, or my sort of hunch is that these are sort of we should really think about these as kind of show ponies, right? They're things that Russia is sending signals about to show everyone that they are still a cutting-edge power, that they're working on cutting-edge systems, but that these are unlikely to ever really be integrated into their overall nuclear plans in sort of a major way, right? These are not going to be the kind of a core part of their nuclear arsenal, at least not in the sort of short or medium term. But it's very hard to know, right? I mean, and you know, I think even sort of people who watch these issues very closely with respect to Russia, there's a lot of debate among that community of experts, and I'm sort of looking in as an outsider into that community, but I think there is a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, Vladimir Putin has he's a guy who sits at the poker table with an incredibly weak hand and manages to win round after round after round, and part of it might be that you know these capabilities that they're developing, you know, hypersonic glide platform, I think they call it the Avangard, right, which is delivered by ICBM, theoretically beats any missile defense system that the U.S. Could put forward. Those unmanned undersea vehicles that, you know, UUVs with a nuclear warhead sitting inside one, they theoretically have global range. So once they get it underway, I think it might be even a nuclear-powered UUV. Mm-hmm. You could park that off of, you know, almost drive it right into the port at San Diego or Norfolk, and the U.S., you know, Pacific or Atlantic fleets are badly decimated if you were to detonate one of those in a hostile action. So there's lots of things they're working on. We also know they're working on some newer versions of their ICBMs and submarine-launched ballistic missiles as well. Those are more traditional delivery capabilities, but more accurate, more reliable maybe, not on par probably still with the U.S., but getting there. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, what's sort of tricky, though, is that, you know, in some way, you know, I mean, you sort of mentioned the ability to get past U.S. missile defense system. I mean, the Russian nuclear arsenal couldn't already get past U.S. missile defense systems. I mean, and U.S. missile defense systems aren't designed to try to sort of prevent a kind of, you know, maybe they can pick off one or two sort of straggling nuclear weapons from a country like North Korea.
Right.
But the idea that you can defend against a you know, an attack from the Russian nuclear arsenal is you know, it just can't do that. So then the question is, well, what extra are they getting from,
right,
from these sort of more kind of exotic capabilities?
Yeah.
And that's really the question that I think we don't yet have an answer to, right? And that's what makes me think this may be more about sort of signaling, you know, that they're still a top-tier country, that they're a sophisticated country, that they have cutting-edge scientists, than it is about really improving sort of their nuclear arsenal with the aim of sort of improving the outcome of a nuclear war for them.
So it's a little bit more about propaganda, and maybe it's just research for the sake of research to see if it can be done.
Right. And, you know, Russia has a big, you know, military scientific bureaucracy. And just like in the United States, those military and scientific bureaucracies sometimes do things that, you know, don't make a ton of strategic sense or don't have the full authorization from above. And, you know, so I think there's a lot of uncertainty.
All right, Mark, let's go ahead and shift over to China. I'd like to cover China, and then we can get into sort of these discussions on how these changes in delivery capabilities might impact deterrence strategy. So for China, and I'm sure you saw this too, recently read the U.S. intelligence community identified a massive new missile silo complex in western China for silo-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. And the assessment is that China is building up their nuclear arsenal, about 300 silos, I think, is what they spotted on imagery. What can you tell us about Chinese nuclear weapons? I think what I saw previously before this discovery of these silos was that there was an estimate of about maybe 300, 350 Chinese nuclear warheads in their arsenal. But clearly that number may have doubled if they have just 300 ICBM silos in the western China. Any insights on developments in China's nuclear strategy and then maybe delivery capabilities as well?
Yeah, so this, I mean, it's an incredibly interesting kind of area and one that's sort of rapidly changing. I mean, just to give us a little bit of historical context, right? I mean, China has sort of pretty consistently had, since they first tested nuclear weapon in 1964, has had a very, relative to the United States and the Soviet Union and now Russia, has consistently had a very small nuclear arsenal and quite a vulnerable nuclear arsenal on a very, very low sort of level of alert, right? And this is kind of a surprise in some ways, right? We would sort of have expected they would have, you know, they're rising power, you know, very potentially significant ambitions in global politics. In some ways, it's sort of odd that they haven't invested significantly in building up their nuclear force. But for a long time, and this was consistent with the views of Chinese leaders going back to Mao, the goal was to sort of have enough weapons that if you were attacked, you would probably be able to attack back, right? And that probability, that possibility would be sufficient to stop anyone from initiating an attack.
So that's real traditional deterrence thinking.
Right, a very sort of, you know, sort of minimum deterrence. We're only going to build as much as we need to sort of stop someone else from attacking us first.
And they have a no first use policy, or have had that consistently
for a long period of time. And relative to, you know, and a sort of reasonably credible no first use policy in the sense that it is reflected in the sort of posture that they have, right? The posture is very much optimized for retaliation and not for first use. But that brings us to these new developments and what we should make of them, right? Because I think, you know, yeah. So as you say, right, there were actually two discoveries of two significant silo fields, and various sort of anonymous quotes from U.S. intelligence folks saying there's actually a third one that hasn't been publicly revealed. So this seems to be a pretty significant buildup. And so the question is what we should sort of think about this. My own view is that actually this is the less significant of developments that are going on in China's nuclear arsenal. I think the way we should interpret these new silos is that, you know, U.S. counterforce capabilities have gotten much more capable over time. And therefore, over time, it has become more plausible that the United States could, in fact, take out all of China's capabilities. And some have argued that actually the United States does have that capability, right? It's not even sort of, you know, wouldn't even be that challenging.
That is correct.
And therefore, right? And therefore, if you're the Chinese, well, what do? The obvious thing to do is to just increase your numbers of missile, right? Give the United States more targets to hit. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, you would do that even if you didn't want to change your posture from a purely retaliatory posture, right? That it would make sense for to build a bunch of silos. You don't even necessarily need to put warheads in all of them, right? But you still, the United States won't know which, and this was what was called the shell game from back in the Cold War.
Yep.
The US wouldn't know which ones have missiles in. So then you have to hit all of them, even if they don't actually all have missiles in them. So I think the sort of increase in silos is, you know, obviously it's not something that the United States would want to have, and it makes it harder for the United States to take out Chinese nuclear capabilities, but that by itself does not indicate, to me at least, a sort of fundamental shift in strategy. What I think the more significant shift is China's investment in some different types of missile capabilities over the last few years, right? So, for example, the DF-26 that came into the Chinese force a few years ago, which is quite similar to the, in some ways, to the Pershing II missile that the US deployed in Europe in the 1980s, right? This is a much more sort of accurate, much more shorter range missile, can potentially be sort of maneuvered in flight, potentially has a hot swapping capability, right? Which is the ability to sort of switch between nuclear and conventional warheads, sort of in the battlefield. That I think, and certain amount of related capabilities, that suggests more of a shift to me and a more of a kind of interest in using nuclear weapons, not simply as a retaliatory capability, and potentially moving towards a sort of a force that at least has some capability, some interest in using nuclear weapons in a conventional military conflict.
And probably more in a tactical sense. Is that a good assessment?
Right. You could use this potentially to sort of, you know, sink U.S. aircraft carriers or keep, you know, U.S. aircraft carriers, you know, further away from Chinese coastlines. And so that's, yeah, I mean, at least plausibly it would have those capabilities, yeah.
So the missile you talked about, the DF-26, that DF stands for Dongfeng, which means east wind, is the translation from Chinese into English. The Chinese have been developing these ballistic missiles for quite some time. The Dongfeng 21 was one of the earlier versions, and that was sort of considered the first of those carrier-killer missiles, and they've continued to advance up to the Dongfeng 26, and I'm sure there'll be more missiles in that line of development as things go on. So these signals, these ambitions that the Chinese are executing right now and advancing or expanding their nuclear footprint, nuclear weapons footprint, how does this impact U.S.-China relations moving forward? Is their goal to sort of get us to consider them to be on par with us from a strategic deterrence perspective? Is it still deterrence for them for the most part? Or do they really plan on getting rid of their first strike, no first strike policy, and maybe using shorter range nuclear ballistic missiles, nuclear armed ballistic missiles in a conflict, like, say, over Taiwan?
Yeah. I mean, I think we don't know fully. you know, I mean, I think these, well, this sort of reflects is a few things. I mean, first, you know, I mean, kind of what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right? The right. U.S., it's hard for the United States to complain about China doing a bunch of things that, A, the U.S. already does and the United States considers to be crucial to its national security and would never consider negotiating away. And second, that these are sort of, you know, in some ways fairly predictable responses to things that the United States has done, right? If the U.S. builds a bunch of highly potent counterforce capabilities, if you're sitting in Beijing, you would be an idiot not to build more retaliatory capabilities to assure your ability to retaliate, even as U.S. offensive capabilities improve. And so, you know, to me, none of this is very surprising. Moreover, I mean, I think, you know, you're right, that it signals a certain amount of ambition. And it has long been the case that Chinese military investments have aimed at pushing the United States further away from China's coastline, right?
Sure. Yep.
China does not like the fact that U.S. Aircraft carriers can, you know, steam through the Chinese, you know, the Straits of Taiwan. It does not like the fact that U.S. highly offensively capable U.S. Naval assets can get very close to China's coast in the same way that the United States wouldn't like it if Chinese submarines and aircraft carriers were, you know, patrolling up the west coast of the United States. And so
and that may happen someday.
Well, sure. And you know, and so I think, you know, a lot of Chinese capabilities, you know, not just in the nuclear realm, but if you look at what they're investing in terms of conventional missile, you know, land to sea missiles or over the horizon radar, greater submarine capabilities. You know, all of these are basically designed to increase the costs for the United States of operating close to China. Yeah. And, you know, it's not at all surprising that China would want those capabilities. But, you know, this doesn't bode well for U.S.-China relations because the United States, you know, has shown no interest in allowing itself to be pushed out of the Western Pacific.
Right.
And as long as the United States, you know, refuses to do that, you're sort of, you know, these capabilities are sort of increasing. But ultimately, I mean, the sort of the tricky thing for the United States moving forward over sort of, you know, the coming decades will be that ultimately it's probably going to be a lot cheaper for China to develop, you know, what are in some ways sort of defensive capabilities, right, that keep the United States at arm's length, than it is for the going to be for the United States to maintain the ability to project that power far away from the United States' own territory, right into China's backyard. And so that sort of the sort of hard truth of that kind of cost calculus, I think, will ultimately kind of start to become more and more challenging for the United States to overcome.
So I would suggest that there's a bit of Chinese grand strategy there, that they recognize that we're $30 trillion in debt, and the more they can push us to have to develop offensive capabilities, which tend to be more expensive, the further they push us into deeper debt.
Yeah, so. And more broad, you know, I mean, you know, U.S. grand strategy, you know, I mean, in some ways, this was not so dissimilar to what the United States did to the Soviet Union in
the last decade
of the Cold War.
That's true.
You know, yeah, I mean, you know, if China wants to presumably be a great power in the way that the United States is, or the way that the Soviet Union was, and part of that is a feeling of that it's entitled to, or its national security benefits from, a sort of sphere of influence, right? This is something the United States has long wanted and long claimed, right? I mean, you know, Monroe Doctrine was all about this, right?
That's right. Yeah.
You know, and so it's, you know, it's not surprising to me that China would want that. And the question is sort of, can the United States come to terms with a situation in which China has a little more influence in its own backyard?
Yeah.
And that necessarily means a little less influence for the United States.
Yep, that's true. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Professor Mark Bell from the University of Minnesota. And we're continuing our discussion from earlier this year in May regarding nuclear strategy, nuclear deterrence, and advanced nuclear weapons delivery capabilities. So Professor Mark Bell, let's move into sort of this discussion on deterrence and nuclear strategy. How do you see nuclear deterrence shaping up in this age of robotics, unmanned platforms, and these advanced nuclear delivery capabilities, hypersonic missiles, for instance, things like that? What does nuclear deterrence look like going forward?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, nuclear deterrence doesn't look that different, in my view. But the problem is that a lot of states, and the United States especially, but other countries as well, want more than deterrence from their nuclear forces, right?
Yeah.
And in this, to this end, I think two sort of sets of capabilities are particularly kind of worrisome in certain ways, or at least threaten the kind of whatever kind of stability we currently have. So one of the various technologies and delivery systems that are packaged up in what some folks call this kind of new era of counterforce, right? That, you know, the accuracy revolution, the remote sensing revolution, hypersonic capabilities, right? All of these potentially give you more offensive capabilities that make it more plausible for more countries to try to take out the nuclear weapons of another country.
Yeah.
And that increases sort of first strike incentives. Basically, it reduces the reliability of countries' second strike capabilities. And as we've seen with China, right, if you reduce the reliability of their second strike capability, they're likely to try to invest in more capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in peacetime. And it, within a crisis, countries may start to get much sort of itchier trigger fingers, right? If they're worried that the United States or another country might be able to take out their capabilities, it makes more sense for you to try to use your capabilities earlier in a crisis. And that's why, you know, in my view, a sort of U.S.-North Korea crisis would be extraordinarily dangerous, because I think North Korea has very good reason to fear that the United States could take out their nuclear capabilities. And therefore, they have very strong incentives to use their nuclear weapons very early in a crisis, right? And so, in my view, a sort of real crisis with North Korea could escalate to the nuclear level much quicker than a lot of folks think, I think. So that's one set of things. It's the sort of all these kind of new era of counterforce technologies. The other big thing I think that we should be thinking about is cyber capabilities. And here it's even trickier in some sense because states can't really advertise the capabilities they have.
Right.
Right. Once you say you can do something, it's generally pretty easy for the adversary to sort of patch whatever vulnerability in their system.
Right.
But again, this has the potential to kind of reduce the reliability of a country's second strike capability, right? If you're North Korea, you're probably pretty worried that the United States has certain cyber capabilities that could just turn your missiles off, right? Could stop them from being launched. And if you're worried about that, you're going to, again, want to use them early before you lose the ability to use them. And so both of these sort of sets of capabilities, I think, and even, you know, it doesn't even have to be the capabilities themselves, but the fears of these capabilities, right? The worry that countries might have these capabilities.
Fear is a tremendous driver of behavior, right?
Right. And exactly. And so, you know, all of these sort of package of things, I think, basically reduce the sort of any kind of crisis stability that we currently have and make crises between nuclear armed states potentially much more dangerous and much more liable to escalate to the nuclear level than has been the case in the past.
So all that said, we know that going back even to the second Obama administration and throughout the Trump administration, there was a lot of discussion about upgrading the U.S. inventory, the entire triad, to the tune of about $1 trillion, I think, is what the number was that I saw, if we wanted to upgrade everything. So considering these challenges that we have, you know, Russia sort of playing their cards and China expanding, should the U.S. maintain the traditional nuclear triad? What do you think?
I mean, the what's interesting about the triad is that as it was developed, there was no sort of strategic logic really for having this set of systems, right? This was something that kind of emerged in a very kind of haphazard, sort of historically kind of contingent way, more driven by like inter-service rivalry, right, really, than it was by any sort of strategic logic. But it's become this sort of thing that you can't question now in mainstream sort of defense politics in DC, that if you're not for maintaining the triad, you're not sort of serious about deterrence in some sense. I mean, my view is that if you just want deterrence, sure, you can do it much more cheaply. You could get rid of all the land-based missiles, and you could get rid of all the Air Force nuclear forces, and you could rely on submarines. You know, this is what the British do. It's what the French do. The submarine force that the United States has is much bigger than the submarine force that any of those other countries have, mm-hmm. and it's completely survivable. And there's no real plausible threat on the horizon to that survivability. So if all you want to do is to be able to retaliate and to guarantee your retaliation in the aftermath of a nuclear attack, and therefore deter that attack from happening, in my view, you could just do that with submarines. But as I sort of suggested earlier, right, I mean, the problem is that the United States doesn't just want deterrence, right? It wants a lot more from its nuclear forces than to simply deter other states from using nuclear weapons against it. It wants the option of using nuclear weapons against other states. It wants not only to deter attacks against the United States, but also against its allies, that it may be harder to credibly signal that the United States will actually fight for. It wants to stop other countries acquiring nuclear weapons. It wants the ability to fight a nuclear war in various locations and at various kind of, you know, levels of escalation. And once you want all those things and the sort of powerful political coalitions that exist in support of those capabilities, I think major reforms start to seem a lot harder, right? And that's part of why it's been so politically difficult for U.S. policymakers to suggest significant reforms to the U.S. sort of nuclear posture. I mean, the Obama administration, right? I mean, didn't really want to do any of this stuff, yeah. But it was basically the price they had to pay to get a new arms control treaty with Russia through the Senate. The Clinton administration tried to conduct a major nuclear posture review that in theory put sort of everything on the table and was going to potentially lead to major reforms, and it was sort of scuttled, very quickly by a sort of combination of different political coalitions that very quickly emerged. So can you do this stuff much more cheaply? Yes. Is there much prospect of that happening? I don't really see it.
Yeah, I agree. So that brings us to the Biden administration. If you were to be an advisor on the National Security Council, taking a look at these issues of nuclear strategy and nuclear deterrence, what would you advise the Biden administration to do on a new nuclear treaty that takes into consideration all these latest developments that we've been talking about today? Would you advise bilateral agreements between the U.S. and Russia, and then another one between the U.S. and China, for instance? Maybe a multilateral between the three big nuclear powers? Or would you push even further for a new treaty amongst all the nuclear powers, current nuclear powers, to try and reduce this danger of nuclear exchanges?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad I'm not advising them. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult, hard time, I think, to be pursuing new arms control efforts. I mean,
tensions are very high.
Yeah, and you know, I think in my view, the basic approach should be a sort of multi-pronged approach. I think trying to do too much is a recipe for achieving nothing. And particularly, I think this idea of sort of a trilateral treaty between the US, Russia, and China, I think is basically a non-starter. And I think trying to achieve that will doom any possibility of achieving anything else. Because China's numbers are, you know, even if you take a sort of maximal view of these latest developments, China's arsenal is still massively below what either the US or Russia has. And so China will just turn around and say, well, you two go ahead and negotiate. And, you know, once you've got your nuclear arsenals down to levels comparable to us, then come back and talk to us then.
Yep.
And that's not an unreasonable position for them to take.
It is not.
So I think the basic approach should be multi-pronged. I mean, I think it should, you know, I think continuing arms controls efforts with Russia beyond, so that there is something to replace a New START with in the aftermath when the extension of New START expires. And again, you know, and this may be less about kind of continuing to try and bring numbers down, although it may be partly that, but more about retaining the sort of inspections and the transparency and frankly, just the kind of institutional venue to discuss these issues that New START provides.
So we need to get back to a trust but verify capability again, since we've sort of
don't trust. Whatever. I mean, you know, don't trust but verify. I mean, you don't, or verify because you don't trust, right? I mean, I think there's sort of, people say, well, you know, the whole point is that you can't, you know, you don't have to make these deals with countries that you trust, right? And therefore, you're always going to be, you know, it's sort of the ugly truth of international politics that you have to make deals with countries you don't much like, and that sort of pragmatism, I think, is going to be really important for some of these efforts, right? So, you know, so I think so that should be one path, right? Is sort of continuing efforts with Russia. I think arms control with China is important, but I think those efforts are going to look very different from the kind of arms control efforts the U.S. saw with Russia. And I think, frankly, they should be, so they're going to be less about numbers because the numbers are at such a different level, right? China just has so far fewer than the United States.
Yeah.
But there are meaningful negotiations that there could be on issues like crisis stability, on potentially on agreements about the kind of assets you might target with cyber capabilities, potentially agreements not to target either country's nuclear command and control systems, for example, ways to potentially reduce the risk of crises escalating to the nuclear level. I think there are a range of productive things that could be discussed and agreements that could be made between the United States and China, but I don't think they'll look very similar to the kind of the sort of salt and start treaties that the US and the Soviet Union signed. And then I think the third priority has to be for the Biden administration trying to fix the sort of mess that the Trump administration left with Iran when it withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, and trying to trying to get the Iranian nuclear program constrained in a meaningful way again. And that, you know, is another sort of big challenge. But so those would be sort of the three areas that I would suggest that the Biden administration pursue, but I think try to pursue them separately. I think trying to tie them together into a sort of grand bargain among, you know, the US, Russia, and China, or all the nuclear armed states, I think is would be great, but I just think is a very high risk approach to take to some of these things. I think it would be better to get some sort of it's better to hit some singles and get on base than it is to, you know, strike out swinging for the fences.
So you're an advocate of Moneyball. You want people to get on base, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, Professor Mark Bell, that has been a fantastic discussion today on nuclear deterrence, new nuclear delivery capabilities, and related topics. So, Mark, what classes are starting up again soon, right after Labor Day? What courses are you teaching in this fall semester?
Yeah, so I'm actually teaching a class on these issues. I'm teaching a class on the politics of nuclear weapons, an upper-level undergrad class. So if any University of Minnesota undergrads are listening, feel free to sign up to that class. It's a good class, and I really enjoy teaching it. It's sort of a class that allows students to really kind of explore, you know, some of the most kind of consequential events of human history over the last 75 years. A lot of the most important issues facing U.S. foreign policy and the foreign policies of other countries. And frankly, just some of the sort of biggest, most important, scariest issues in international politics today. And so it's always a good class. It's a fun class to teach.
I can imagine there are some pretty great discussions that go on in the classroom. Hopefully that'll be able to happen in the face-to-face manner. We'll see how the Delta variant impacts us.
Yeah.
So we've reached the end of our show for this week. Professor Mark Bell, thank you so much for joining us a second time here on National Security This Week.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to our show again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. If you have ideas for topics you'd like us to cover, please contact KYMN Radio. I'll find experts who can join us to address your topic. Have a fantastic finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.